you referenced the broiler industry. You can make those changes very quickly. Generation turnover is very rapid. That is not the case on the beef side. So, you know, if I want to start thinking about, you know, calves are being born in South Dakota right now, or we're, you know, nearing the end of calving season, you know, so a calf born in 26, I want to keep her as a replacement. I'm breeding her in 27 for her to calve in 28 to produce beef on the marketplace in 29.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Kemin invites you to optimize animal feed quality and safety with our portfolio of solutions. Learn more at kemin.com/ag. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge. Don't hire another VA stuck in 2015. Hire a remote AI specialist from Latin who runs AI tools, works in your time zone, and helps your team move faster. Schedule your free strategy call at www.wisevas.io. Zentrix Insights. The right person in the right seat starts with knowing how your team is actually wired. Visit ZentrixInsights.com. Zentrix OS, the business operating system built for teams who are serious about goals, tasks, and measurable results. One platform to run your entire operation. Revenue grew, so did your hours. The owner's box, buy back 20 a week. Stop hiring for problems automation can solve. Start with Elevate Agents.
Welcome to the Feed Science Podcast. I'm Adam Fairnels, coming to you from the Animal Food Manufacturing Program here at North Carolina State University. On behalf of WiseNetics, thanks for joining us. As always, please do like, subscribe, do all those good things on whatever your podcast vehicle of choice is, or if you're watching on YouTube, leave us a comment, let us know what you like about the topics you see, what you might like to see more of in the future. I'm excited today. Our guest is going to talk to us a little bit about some things that are a little outside my particular area of expertise, which is always great because I like when we do these and I get to learn something as well. So our guest is Dr. Warren Rushi. Warren, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
You bet. So Warren is an assistant professor and an extension beef feedlot management specialist at South Dakota State University. And he's going to talk to us today about some things related to beef carcass size. But before we jump into that, Warren, would you mind giving the audience a bit more of your background? I know you've done some of these podcasts before, but for any of the audience that aren't familiar with your background, if you'd share that, that'd be great.
Sure. So as you said, I'm the extension feedlot management specialist here at South Dakota State. And I've taken kind of a long route to get here. I started out, I tell people I'm a product of the 80s farm crisis, and that turned into, even though I really wanted to farm, that wasn't going to be the option, at least right away. So I went undergraduate here at South Dakota State, got a master's at Kansas State University, started out my career in county extension, and then did have a chance to go back home. We worked on our family's cattle feeding and cow-calf operation, and through kind of a long chain of events, after about a dozen years or so, my wife and I determined that that business path wasn't going to be viable. So we ended up going back to extension, first in a regional role at a cow-calf. And then the university decided that might make a good sense to turn me into a feedlot person. And so I, while at the same time, worked on my PhD, which I wrapped up about 5 years ago. And so I've had this faculty role ever since. I think what that does give me is some advantages in terms of what I do now, in that I've had different roles within the beef industry, from both the cow-calf to the cattle feeding side. And the fact that I've done this on my own as a producer, I think gives me at least some idea of what our producers are dealing with as we start trying to think about managing their operations.
Gotcha. Yeah. And on the extension side, having done it yourself doesn't hurt with the credibility side either, right? You go out and you can talk to them and they go, yeah, it seems like he actually knows what he's talking about. No, you've done it before. Okay. You're not just coming and pretending like you know.
Yeah, it does help a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll bet.
Feed formulation software is stuck in the past. Most tools haven't evolved beyond basic least cost optimization. A Diet Forge changes that. It's an AI-powered platform with nonlinear ingredient modeling for enzymes and additives, cost per gain and maximum profit optimization, and real-time collaboration like Google Docs for nutrition. Every recommendation is grounded in world-class research, built for modern nutritionists who need more than legacy desktop software can deliver. Work seamlessly with your team and optimize the way modern operations demand. Try DietForge.ai free today. Feed formulation, finally modernized.
All right, so the topic for today is going to be beef carcass size, and I think it's not a surprise to anybody, as it would be in a lot of our food animal industries. Carcass size and animal size overall has increased as we've changed genetics and feeding practices and things like that, and it's been going that way since it's got to be 50 plus years. And certainly with the increase in things like integration and very concentrated feeding and programs and things like that, things have certainly, continued to grow. And so there's no signs of that stopping. And so I think the idea today would be to talk about what some of the signals that the market's sending that's telling us why those things are happening. So let's just start with that. Let's start with the very easy, the very simple question with probably not a so simple answer. Why have the feeders continued to increase that final body weight and carcass size in beef cattle?
Well, to lead off with the answer, it's because it's more profitable to do so. So kind of why I got interested in this particular topic and talking about it was in part driven by an email response that I received last summer from an article some of our communications people put out, where the headline, they were talking about our research here, and their headline they chose was bigger and better cattle or bigger and better beef or something like that. And that wasn't necessarily what I would have picked, but it fit what we were doing. And I got some feedback from a producer that really took a bit of an exception to that in terms of, in their view, we would be better served having more moderate sized cattle from an efficiency standpoint. And so I thought there's a bit of a disconnect within there, as you think about all the way from the cow calf to the finished beef side on why we're doing some of what we do. And so that's kind of the genesis of why I've been talking about this topic the last few months. But we did some research on taking a set of cattle and extending days on feed. And the real short answer to that, when we get down to adding in all the costs, including interest, yardage, the added feed, all of those things, in some cases, adding some discounts from a carcass standpoint, because as we get them heavier, feed them longer, we make them fatter. Taking all that into account, the longer we fed them, the more money we made. And that, that's really something the cattle feeders have figured out, and known pretty intuitively. From a bigger picture standpoint, the tolerance from the packing side for heavier and fatter carcass has increased over time. To some extent, we've taken the fat packing industry, we've drug them kicking and screaming, in part because it makes sense on the feedlot side to add more pounds. The other part, given the current state of the beef industry, the packing plants really are forced to because of shorter cattle number. In order to supply beef demand, it requires those animals to be heavier. Some of the challenges are on going forward are in some of the cutability and just physical size standpoint. But the economic signal is right now saying we need pounds and we're willing to pay for it.
Gotcha. So I do want to talk a little bit more, obviously, about those implications, some of those unintended consequences. But just going back to the profitability side for a minute, this obviously is an economy of scale type argument. I'm wondering how much, and not that you can assign a percentage to each, but how much of it is economy scale in the operations themselves, as far as, how long the cattle are staying in the feedlot, and therefore, the amount of time and having to switch them out and feed them and everything else is economy of scale, being able to operate larger feedlots. And then how much of it is economy of scale, literally of the animal itself, and it being more economical to try to feed, you know, one steer out to this weight instead of it taking, you know, 1.2 steers to get to that weight. So I'm curious about the economy of scale, both operationally and on the actual animal side.
I would say it's about 50-50. If we just go to the biology, and some of this has been driven by as our industry has shifted from selling cattle on a live weight basis to selling it on a carcass weight basis, that the way the composition of that final weight gain has changed some of this. Because if we just measure feed efficiency on a live gain standpoint, we know that they get less efficient as they get towards the end of the feeding period. What the difference is when we do that, when we're measuring carcass weight gain, that efficiency drop off is not nearly so dramatic. Our data said that, you know, steers are gaining close to 2 pounds a day carcass gain, even out to some fairly extended. That study I referenced, our final average weight on steers for the longest feeding group is 1,700 pounds, and they were still gaining nearly 2 pounds a day carcass weight. Well, now we start, you know, at somewhere around $3.80 for a pound of carcass, start doing that math that we're adding $7.50 per day, and then compare that to our cost, that makes that profitable. So that's kind of on an individual animal basis, and it's why even our smaller, relatively speaking, smaller scaled feeders here in the upper Midwest have adapted this maybe to a faster extent than that. Then when you start looking at just overall financial management, the animal, if I don't have to go buy a replacement animal, and, you know, and that the feeder cattle market has been absolutely on fire in the last year. The longer I own, I can put pounds on the animal already own. It helps out from a capital standpoint and some other things. So we really have two different drivers of this. It's what's going on biologically that's saying, given the current market conditions, it's profitable to add weight to that animal. And then simply the financial implications of that are, if I can feed the animal we already own rather than sell it and then buy a very valuable animal to replace it, that helps me keep the yard fuller longer. To some extent, reduces the amount of burn I have from a capital standpoint. So there's really those two factors are both going on.
Something else that I was curious about, if you could speak to, we've got a lot of folks that would listen that would be anywhere from the feed industry to the various different food animal industries. When we talk about something like trends in like the feeder cattle market, let's say that something happens in poultry, right? And we'll talk about, you know, broiler chickens specifically. And something's changing in the market that would make me want to make them heavier, make them lighter. Those are changes I can make pretty quick, right? Because we're talking 2 months or less worth of feeding cycle. Every time we place new birds, then we can kind of make that decision. But obviously, in the feeder cattle market, we're feeding them for a lot longer, but also it's going to be, we're feeding them a lot longer in the feedlot. We're also very dependent on what they're coming to us at from a weight size coming off like that background or that cow-calf operation. So If let's say the trend did shift because prices change, and so hold on, maybe we don't want to grow them as big. What kind of time like is that? What's a cycle?
Sure. So one of those signals could happen very quickly, and you know my colleague was just at a conference with a consulting firm, and you know they were talking about if there were some changes on the packing side of things where. If the processors then regain some leverage, let's say, pick your company, closed a plant, they could, that tolerance for fatter carcasses, they might see heavier discounts quicker. And so that could happen very quickly. And then that would mean now our decision-making on individual pens of cattle might have to change in terms of, well, we can't tolerate as many fours. More yield grade fours and fives are now costing us more money. We may need to shift our target. Long term, one of the big stories on this is, we have an incredibly strong retail beef demand for beef, even at these very strong prices. But that's because of a whole lot of reasons, including drought, labor, capital, all kinds of things. We are not really adding a lot of additional cows to the breeding. That change is going to take a lot of time. You know, and it's simple. You know, you reference the broiler industry. You can make those changes very quickly. Generation turnover is very rapid. That is not the case on the beef side. So, you know, if I want to start thinking about, you know, calves are being born in South Dakota right now, or we're, you know, nearing the end of calving season. You know, so a calf born in 26, I want to keep her as a replacement. I'm breeding her in 27 for her to calve in 28 to produce beef on the marketplace in 29. You know, some of these economic signals are going to be, you know, measuring in months and years that before we start really dramatically changing. Because, and by the way, ranchers, at least in South Dakota, are really not adding a lot of cows inventory of replacement efforts. We're, depending on where you're at, for a big part of the state, we're very concerned about moisture right now and feed supply. And so the overall theme or goal right now is to figure out how to maintain the cows we have without necessarily looking to add more. And in part, you know, there's, right now the market is saying we need feeder cattle. They're rewarding you to send heifers into the supply chain. So there's a little bit of the packer can change their signals very quickly. The ranch side, the feeder cattle supply is not going to change rapidly.
All right. Again, my guest today is Dr. Warren Rushi. Warren's an assistant professor at South Dakota State University, and we're talking about carcass size in beef cattle, especially feedlot cattle that are coming into the market. One of the other things, and you've talked already a lot about it, I'm curious if there's anything else you'd like to cover specifically. One of the things that's also very interesting about the way that the feedlot cattle system works with the feeders is it's right in the middle of that supply chain of the animal, right? So, and they've got to depend on the cow-calf. They've got to depend on backgrounding, like you said. And then, of course, it's got to go to the packer, and it's going to eventually go to retail. And so I assume there's, as you've already talked about, there's all this kind of push-pull on what makes sense for each individual segment. So I guess I would ask, are all of the segments happy with this direction, or some of them not happy with them? And at the end of the day, who has the most power? Does everybody kind of get to split the power equally because everybody needs everybody?
So that's a great question. And I would say we're not all equally, there's some concerns about all of this. And I'll start working backwards. I'll start at the packing and work to the cow-calf. From the packing standpoint, they are needing pounds to come in. They're economy of scale business, and so they've certainly been along for the ride from that standpoint. However, they have some concerns on these carcass sizes. You've got a larger mass of the carcass that takes more energy to cool down. In some cases, the physical infrastructure plant might be limiting how big a carcass we can handle. There's some labor things. So there are some limitations from that standpoint that the retailer and the processor needs to deal with. You know, even things like, you would think that more muscling is always better. Well, you know, if you have a 17.5-inch steak, that either becomes more than someone wants to spend for it, or we cut it thin enough so that we meet the right price point, and now it becomes very hard to cook. So, you know, there's some portion size issues that come about from that part of it. On the packer side, on the cattle feeder side, one of the drawbacks of this trend towards making cattle bigger is we've also increased physical challenges in terms of physically being able to handle the cattle. We've made them larger, but we haven't really changed the heart, the lung capacity. We haven't changed the feet and legs. And so from that standpoint, we create some health issues. I should have also mentioned that from the packer standpoint, and to some extent on the feeder, as we've made them bigger, we've made them fatter. That creates some challenges in terms of trim loss, maybe some feed efficiency aspects, that right now we're just kind of tolerating, but there may come a time where we start paying a lot more attention to that. If we go all the way down to the cow-calf side, you know, we're the wonderful thing about the beef industry is we've got so much diversity and so many different approaches to raise livestock that we don't necessarily have some of the other protein species. The challenge is we have to, we're raising cattle in Florida and in Montana and everywhere in between, all those different kinds of environments to create hopefully a consistent product from all of these different environmental conditions we have cattle to make a living in. And so the cow that works in Central Florida is not the same cow that works in Western South Dakota. And so as we start thinking about making cattle bigger, one of the potential drawbacks is that we may also be making cows bigger. That isn't necessarily in all instances a great thing from a feed standpoint. Now, the good news in some of that, in Dr. Paul Beck at Oklahoma State did a really nice job of summarizing some of the information on cow size and carcass weight, is that we're able to make cattle that we can make big out of some relatively moderate-sized cows. That study I referenced that we did here at South Dakota State, that was in partnership with the North American Limousine Foundation, where they worked with a couple commercial ranches in Montana. And the person that coordinated all that said, yeah, those cows were not necessarily all that big, nothing out of the ordinary, but we were able to take the sons and daughters, the steers out of those, up to 1,700 pounds without any real issues from either health or cutability standpoint. So that managing that variability and dealing with some of these unintended consequences as we start pushing things farther to the, pushing the envelope a little farther, I think that's where our challenges are from a cattle management standpoint. Is how do we take all of these very varied industries communication across sectors is getting better, but we're certainly not linked to the same degree that poultry, swine, or even dairy might be. So we've got more independent operators up and down the chain with all differing approaches and priorities of what the ideal beef animal looks like in their segment of business.
So I guess, and I would assume that that's, a pretty significant part of like the research that you're looking at, right? Is how do you mitigate those and how do you, like, what ideas are out there, I guess, practically, but also I'm guessing a lot of it is just, as it is with anything else today, pulling the data together from all of these places. And in your case, you've got a lot of different operations that are going to have everything from lots of data and lots of things you can plug into a market analysis to ones that have next to none, because that's just not how they've operated forever. So what does that look like from a data management type of a standpoint?
That's a great question. The packing and the feedlot industry do a pretty good job of managing data. As you alluded to, on the cow-calf sector, that's a little more hit or miss. Some of what we focus on is just transferring information, even as simple as things like health records and so forth. What we're also working on, I don't know if this is exactly what you're getting at, but in terms of data and knowledge, some of the things we're working on a research standpoint is how do I take some of this variation that exists on the cow herd and then figure out how to create a consistent product on the other end. And so we're looking at things like, and this does relate, I think, to your audience, things like using roughage to a greater degree. We think that's one of the approaches that makes sense to take animals that maybe come from a more moderate or smaller frame cow and use a roughage to manipulate the growth curve to essentially build skeleton, build muscle before we start putting on fat. As a strategy to be able to have outweights that have been increased without changing the genetics on the cow side. From a technology standpoint, implants and specifically on the feed, the beta agonists, things like Optiflex, Experior, and so forth, are tools that we can use really effectively to change how that looks like in terms of output. And then we've been doing some work on just differing approaches to nutrient requirements. For instance, we've been doing quite a bit of work here in the last 3 or 4 years on incorporating soy protein into your cattle diets. That's not something we've looked at traditionally, really, for 25, 30 years. With the advent of corn processing, our industry has used the distillers' grains, corn gluten, and so forth as kind of our go-to. We're taking a second look, and some of that's been driven by changes in soy crush and now more recently just changes in the soybean market. But we've been adding soy protein, whether that's heat-treated or conventional soybean meal, and seeing some really interesting responses that, again, are helping us increase what we're seeing is increased output without necessarily changing anything from the genetic standpoint necessarily. It's a technology that we can use in that one sector in the feedlot without asking downstream producers to change how they're doing business.
Yeah, no, that is very interesting, and as you kind of alluded to, from folks in kind of the animal food manufacturing side of the world, it's also interesting for those that don't know a lot of what goes on in the feedlot. In a lot of cases, the only processing that exists there is maybe like some steam flaking of some corn. And other than that, it's going into effectively TMR type wagons mixed with roughage, everything else. So, in our world, work some like soy protein in is, okay. So it's another ingredient that goes in, but one extra ingredient in the feedlot is not a small thing. Like that's something for them to have to deal with that they are not generally, set up to do.
Yeah, and that's been, some of our, started reporting out some of our data, some of the initial studies, we got some pushback from some of the consulting world and the cattle feeders that, I'm not sure we want to do that, but because of added complexity. But one of the other things that's, I think, changing is, as we've seen this incredibly strong beef demand, and it's translating into greater cattle values, we can start affording to do some things that 15, 20 years ago we just couldn't do. When a pound of extra carcass weight is worth nearly $4, and there's that incentive in terms of maintaining or even improving us from a quality standpoint, we can start justifying some investment into feed inputs that didn't make sense, when I was coming up in the industry, where we were trying to be the low cost producer at all times. And I think we're starting to get a mindset shift to we're not the lowest cost protein, and that's not our niche and shouldn't be. But so we can start making some investments that. Whether that's a different mineral source or a feed ingredient that perhaps costs a little bit more on the front end, but we're seeing some improvements in terms of output or quality. So in that standpoint, it's kind of exciting. To me, this is a fun business to be in right now, where our concern now, when I was an undergrad, our concern was demand was crashing and how does this business stay viable? Now we're talking about incredibly strong demand and how do we grow to meet that? And so I can tell you from experience, one of those two chapters is a lot more fun to be working in than it was back in the early 90s when we were really just thinking about survival.
Yeah, absolutely. And it can go a lot of different ways from here, right? The feeders themselves can develop different technologies that will allow them to change maybe how they provide nutrition, or there's opportunities for commercial companies to build up infrastructure to the point where, okay, no, we can have all this effectively base mixed and pre-mixed and ready to come to you, so you don't have to do it yourself. And so there's an opportunity for folks there. But I'm with you. I mean, it's always interesting as we move in any of the food animal worlds to maybe actually looking at some more investment in the nutrition side and in the processing side. And we start getting into that efficiency down into that cent per ton, cent per pound range, because we're looking for every last little bit. That's where the science really becomes important, right? And the management and the animal welfare and the overall kind of gross structure of how we do things is always going to be, you know, the 90% of the production, but that last 10% is where the science gets to have a lot of fun and go, okay, where are the margins at? And that's always enjoyable.
Yeah. That soy protein I've been talking about, that's been a really fun area because we've seen responses of 20 to 30 pounds of carcass weight. And we tell that to a cattle feeder, their eyes get big and they can start doing the math. And they're figuring out how to incorporate that. And then we're going to be starting up a research project just in a few weeks where I think it'll also help on the feed industry side where we're looking at incorporating that soy protein into a value added feed stuff that from a feed manufacturer now rather than that type B feed that we would have used to for that beta agonist, instead of using the cheapest carrier we could find, we may be able to start incorporating some higher value. Create a value-added feed that would also then generate into more margin, more commissions from the sales staff, kind of a virtuous circle where everyone gets a little, we grew the pie and everyone gets a little bigger piece.
Yeah, very, very cool. Well, it's been a fun discussion. I've really enjoyed it. Like I said, not my typical area of expertise, but, kid from Kansas originally, and so always talking about beef cattle is always kind of fun for me. Still got a lot of friends and folks, acquaintances that are in that world. So always like to hear a little bit about what's going on and the science about what's doing as well. So I do appreciate the conversation.
It's been great to visit with you, and I've really enjoyed it.
Again, my guest today has been Dr. Warren Rushi. Warren is an assistant professor in the Extension Beef Feedlot Management Specialist at South Dakota State University. Again, thank you for listening to the Feed Science Podcast. I am Adam Fairnolds, coming to you from North Carolina State University. On behalf of Wise Genetics, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you the next time.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.